Welcome to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Day two of preparation for the 2010 Indianapolis 500 is complete. And despite cloudy and overcast conditions throughout the day, and on and off drizzle, we were still very busy. 914 laps turned, 33 different cars and drivers on track today. And the quickest, the same as yesterday, the same as last year in qualifying, and ultimately the same driver that reached victory lane last year for the third time. Elio Castroneves working on a fourth, 227.046 today, a little bit faster than his top speed yesterday, more than 2 miles an hour faster than the pole speed he set from last year. Also, Scott Dixon, Dario Franchitti, Will Power, and Tony Kanaan all faster than last year's pole speed. Could have been an aerodynamic toe that helped them in that regard. Mario Marias was six quicker than last year's pole speed, just shy of 224.9 last year. Marias was over 225. Rest of the top 10, Dan Weldon, Ryan Briscoe, Marco Andretti, and Graham Rahal. Also of note, 11 through 15, Vitor Mira, Townsend Bell, Danica Patrick, A.J. Foyt IV, and Hideki Muto. All of the rookies have now passed rookie orientation. All of the veterans that had refresher courses have completed that to satisfaction of Indy Racing League officials. We had our first contact with the wall today at just before 4:30. Dan Weldon lost control in turn number 4, slid and hit the wall on the front straight. He was able to get out of the car under his own power, checked and released from the infield care center, and Weldon will be reevaluated for bruising on his right foot at some point. There was some fear early that the damage would be somewhat significant, but the reports I'm hearing now is that all things considered, with contact with the wall, not that bad, and will be something that a little extra work will allow Panther to be ready with the number 4 National Guard car by noon tomorrow. That's when practices open tomorrow, noon until 6, and the gates will open at 9. Telephone number is 239-1070. On the weekends, the number is 239-1070. Hope you can join us this evening. Your questions of a historical or nostalgia nature concerning the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We welcome your thoughts for Donald Davidson. Good evening, Donald.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
Good. We had more activity than I feared we were going to have today, so I think everybody got some good work in.
I know it's spotted with rain. I was not on the grounds until on into the afternoon, and I just thought it was going to be stop and go all day, but it looks like they've got a lot more done than I would have thought.
And everybody was out there waiting. In some cases, they might have said, you know what, there's going to be too much of this stopping and starting. We'll just take the day off. But they really can't afford to do that because we might see rain tomorrow, Tuesday, Wednesday. You don't know how many chances you're going to get. So.
Absolutely. You've got to get it when the track is dry because you just schedule now, you just have to get the track every opportunity you can.
And we're only separated by 9 miles an hour. From the top speed to the bottom speed, actually much less than that, just over 8 miles an hour is what we're talking about. So everything's pretty tight, and if you want to look at lap times, the difference is 1.5 seconds.
That's it.
Is what we're talking about.
The
from the first, the quickest, to the 33rd.
That's the point I've been making for a while, that you look at the speed differential and you think, oh, that's a huge gap. Not on the clock it isn't.
Yeah, let's look at, for example, from first through, say, sixth, we're talking about 0.3 of a second over 2.5 miles. 0.3 of a second.
And that's, but the spread in miles per hour is 2 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. I think up in this area, I think 0.1 of a second is 1 mile an hour.
Wow. 239-1070 is the telephone number if you have something for us. We'll start with Jay in St. Paul tonight, I believe. Jay, welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Jay.
Hello again. Donald, I have a question about, I've seen photos of two flagmen, one up high and one down low, and I wonder if you could just do a little history of flagmen at the speedway.
Oh, history of flagmen? Well, as far as the positions are concerned, they had a rope bridge that went, I think it was there in 1911 even. I'm not sure about that. Certainly by 1915, I think, there was a suspended rope bridge that the flagman would stand on. But for many years, you had the starters stand on the outside of the track up high, approximately where it is now, except it was a wooden structure. And then you had, but that was only used for the race. For qualifications, it was down at ground level. And then typically for race day, or for the finish at least, you would have a second flagman down at track level. And certainly Bill Vandewater, who was the flagman from 54 to 61, he liked to operate it from the track, and Pat Vidan did also. In fact, we've talked about that because Bill Vandewater and Pat Vidan liked to flag on the track. And at some point, they moved Pat off of the track and had a little wooden platform that was on the grass verge, and it was only probably 7-8 inches high, I think. And he would flag on that platform, but he really liked to get down onto the track. But either way, there was room where he could do this little acrobatic twirl at the conclusion of qualifications, at least. When anybody completed a qualifying run, he would do like a little skip and then go down on one knee as he was twirling the flag. And when Tom Binford became the chief steward in 1974, one of the first things that he asked for was to move the operation with the chief steward and his few lieutenants. He thought that they were too vulnerable if they were down at trackside, and that he preferred to have them up high. So a little stand was built in time for 1974. Two levels. You climbed up several flights or several steps, and then on the first area, the first level was the starter, and then the second level was an enclosed booth with windows that maybe a half a dozen people would be in. And just basically, it was race control, except they didn't call it that. But Pat Vidan was not very happy because he was still out in the open, but it considerably restricted his routine, and I remember he was not very happy. But certainly now I think about 11, 12, there's photos of the winner taking the checkered flag, and the flagman is down at ground level. And then I think in 15 they've got this rope bridge, and I think that probably went through the 20s. I don't think that lasted very long. The wooden structure on the outside was certainly there by 27, I think. I mean, it might have been there before that. And once again, they would flag qualifications from track level, and then the race would be done from up high.
Okay.
Now we've got this modern thing, which is beautifully designed because of the fact that you can see through it. There's very little obstruction of vision for the people, whichever angle they're watching from.
What years did Pat Vidan flag?
Bill Vandewater passed away in the winter of 61-62. So Pat Vidan went from 62 until 79.
Okay.
And then Dwayne Sweeney was 80 until, I think, 95 or 96.
Jay, thanks for the call.
Thanks, Jay.
Yeah, thank you.
I wanted to ask you, up something that I don't know the answer to. We know of Tom Binford. He was the chief steward here when I first started covering the race. And you mentioned in 74 is when he began. He is known as a well-known businessman in the Indianapolis area.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
How did he get to this point? We think of the chief steward now. Brian Barnhart is a racing guy.
It's a full-time job. Yeah.
What was Tom Binford's background in racing, and how did he become the chief steward?
Well, he was, he was a businessman, and very, very active in the early days of the United States Auto Club. I mean, he came on board almost immediately. There was the Burnett Binford Lumber Company and the DA Lubricants Company. So he was involved. He'd been a fan as a kid. And DA Lubricants sponsored cars under his leadership, and then he, in 57, became the president of the United States Auto Club, and it was not a paid position. I don't even know if it was a dollar a year. I think maybe he just got expenses, but the director of competition was like the full-time the day-to-day person that was on salary at the office, and that was Dwayne Carter and then later Henry Banks. But Tom Binford was the president of USAC from 57 through until 68, or actually January of 69, when he gave it up, and then Charlie Brockman, who was a broadcaster, took over the presidency. Well, Tom Binford, in the meantime, had not been involved with USAC very long, and then he got involved with a group called ACCOS, and it's the Automobile Competition Committee of the United States. And this gets a little complicated, but the FIA, Fédération Internationale de l'Automobile, or however that's pronounced, they have, it's a worldwide body, and they have dozens and dozens of countries that come under the FIA, and in most cases, and probably every case but the United States, there will be one sanctioning body for the country, and then they, you know, report to, if you like, to the FIA, or come directly under the FIA. Well, in the United States, because you had several organizations that of stature, there was United States Auto Club, there was NASCAR, there was Sports Car Club of America. A little later on, there was IMSA, International Motorsports Association, I think is what that, anyway, something like that. And then NHRA, I don't know if I mentioned them.
Sure.
Well, they all came under the FIA. And so what you had was, instead of each country having one sanctioning body, because there were several in the United States, they came under the umbrella of ACCOS, and ACCOS represented the United States to the FIA. And I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but Tom Binford was probably one of the architects of making that happen, so that you could have interchange of driver, and so you could have NASCAR drivers come and run the 500 without joining USAC, and the USAC drivers could go run the Daytona 500 and Sebring and everything else without certain major events. That you could have interchange of driver without fear of disciplinary action for racing outside of your own fold. And I don't know if that makes any sense. But anyway, the thing, the whole point of all of this is that Tom Binford was very much of a Henry Kissinger type. He was just an amazing low-key diplomat. And so Harlan Fengler had been the chief steward of the 500 since from 1958, and there were several stormy years, and unfortunately he didn't have the best rapport with the press, and the press will usually win.
They always have the last word.
They always have the last word. And so honestly, he was a very dedicated man, but he didn't really do anything to help himself in that regard, and so members of the press had been urging Tony Holman to get somebody else. Well, Tony Holman was always very slow to make a decision like that because he didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And how Tom Binford's name came up, I don't know, but if it was in the works for a while, I believe that it was Ray Marquette of the Indianapolis Star that had as much to do as anybody with pushing it along. And so he actually believed that it was about to happen, and so he actually broke the story. And Tom Binford, in his typical, you know, self-effacing way, and somebody said, when did you first know that you were going to be the chief steward for the Indianapolis 500? He said, when I read about it in the Indianapolis Star. Well, anyway, it did come to pass, and so he came in and just, you know, aligned himself or surrounded himself with the best people that he could get for technical chairman and, you know, the chief observer. And there's like about six, seven positions, and each one of those positions have a lot of people that report to them. And so basically he was sort of like the captain of the ship. He didn't know how to, you know, run the boiler room, but he knew the guy that did. And so anyway, he probably could have been the chief steward a lot longer. I don't really remember him having any issues, and he had some thorny issues to deal with, but he did it very, always very, very diplomatically. And he basically, he kept saying, I'm not going to do another one, and he always would. And then the other thing, too, is that I would say that for a number of years, probably, and I don't know if I get any argument from civic leaders on this, I'd say that for a number of years, Tom Binford was probably the number one citizen in the city, including the mayor. And then you would start to see more and more reports, because he was on, I don't know how many board of directors. I mean, he was on dozens and dozens of organizations. And all of the movers and shakers always said, if you want to get something done, you get Tom Binford on the board, or at least on your side, and you can get it done. I mean, he was the president of the Indiana National Bank, and he didn't know anything about banking. He was the president of the Pacers for a while. Mm-hmm. And so basically, whenever they needed somebody, Tom Binford was your man. He just was an amazing fellow, and very witty. And, you know, used a manual typewriter or electric typewriter to, you know, write all of his speeches. And just if he wrote a note, they were usually very brief, but at least one sentence had some humor in it. So he was just a very special person.
Interesting. 239-1070 is our telephone number. If you have a question for Donald, I believe Chris is up next on the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Donald. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate you doing that. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I was wondering if you could talk about the last active F1 driver and the last active NASCAR driver. If you could talk about who those were and how they fared in the race. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
The last active NASCAR driver or...
The last, who was active in NASCAR and then who was also active in F1?
Well, that's a bit of a gray area. The last active driver, the most recent active driver would be John Andretti, I suppose, and he doesn't run a full schedule, but he ran in the 500 last year. So I don't know if that's the answer you wanted. I mean, if you, Leroy Yarborough and K.O. Yarborough, Donnie and Bobby Allison were both active NASCAR drivers when they did it,
but Robbie Gordon.
Robbie Gordon also.
Tony
sure.
Stewart.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. Except that's a lot more recent. So F1, I'd have to give some thought to that because it's been a while.
So maybe his question is the last time an active F1 driver competing that year competed in the 500.
Well, that's been a while because now that, although I don't think this has ever been said publicly, when you have a super license, you don't run anything else. And so that's why you don't have Lewis Hamilton and Michael Schumacher running the 24 Hours of Le Mans, because when you're a Formula One driver, that's all you do.
Now, I know a little bit of the super license, but I did not know that part of it. I know a super license is required for Formula One, and that's a great expense to get one of those.
But that's,
as I understand it, you are not allowed to compete
that's
in any other type of racing.
That's what I understand, and I don't think that's out there, you know,
no,
publicly.
I did not know that.
But I think that probably goes, I think that's probably 15, 20 years that there's a clause in there that nobody will talk about that does preclude you. So that's all you do. So, Clay Regazzoni in 77 is the last one that I can think of that was actually running Grand Prix at the same time, because, you know, we've had, Johnny Herbert, except that I don't think Johnny Herbert had a Formula One ride when he
He wasn't doing Formula One that year. Now, Mario was later than 77, still competing full-time in F1.
All right,
I don't know how late. As late as 81, because that's why he started in the back, correct?
That's absolutely right. Well, you're very good. He was driving for Alfa Romeo.
Okay.
And that was about the end when he was running the whole season. So that would probably be Mario. Yeah, very good. I'm glad you're here tonight.
Well, we're going to have to research this super license thing, because I've heard this come up, and I've never thought it was realistic considering the salaries that the current Formula One stars make, but people will say that, what if you could get Lewis Hamilton to come over here? He apparently can't.
No, he apparently,
without taking a season off.
That's yes, and I mean, with all of this discussion now maybe we can find that out, but I understand that that's been so, as I say, probably 15-20 years, and it's never been said, but apparently it's there.
We'll put Kirk Cavan on that, so he can find that.
But, you know, the time was when in 67, for instance, it's come up quite a few times in the last few years about the fact that in 67 you had Jim Clark, Jochen Rindt, Graham Hill, Jackie Stewart, Dennis Holm were all here, Pedro Rodriguez, Chris Amon, Richie Ginther. And if I don't know if I mentioned Dan Gurney in with that lot.
No.
So, all right. Well, then I think there was like six current Grand Prix guys in the lineup that ran a Grand Prix last weekend. They're in the 500 today, and they're going to be in a Grand Prix next weekend. And then there was those others that I mentioned that were here and didn't make it. I mean, Pedro Rodriguez, Lucien Bianchi, Richie Ginther, I think there's another one that I mentioned that Chris Amon.
Yep.
That's four guys that were ranking Formula One drivers active that were here and didn't make it. So, but that all came to a screeching halt. And other than Andretti, you know, and I tip my hat to you on that one because he did run in 81 Formula One, and he drove for Alfa Romeo, and I think that might have been his last year. Now he did come back. And he ran the Long Beach Grand Prix for Williams, and then he ran a couple of races at the end of the year after the death of Gilles Villeneuve. Mario drove, he ran the Italian Grand Prix, and I think one or two others for Ferrari in 82, but I mean that was just as a substitute. But Regazzoni was probably the last foreign regular Formula One driver that ran here. Because, I mean, even, you know, Michele Alboreto, who came here and nobody seemed to know who he was. And I thought, this guy drove for Ferrari for 5 years and he was second in the world championship. And he came here and you know, people didn't even... Oh, well, Piquet also was here, but no longer an active Formula One driver.
Yeah, there have been quite a few as recently as this year. Takuma Sato is a former Formula One driver who's a rookie here at Indianapolis. We had Enrique Bernoldi a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
That had driven in Formula One. Justin Wilson has driven in Formula One, and there are others
Nigel Mansell was the world champion in 92, but he
Emerson Fittipaldi.
But he gave it up.
Yeah, they had essentially retired
from
Formula One. Let me ask you this. We know that Indianapolis was a points-paying race in the world championship in the 50s through, what, about 1960?
Yeah, 50 through 60.
Okay.
Very good.
Was with so many Formula One drivers competing, because at that time there weren't actually very many, if any. Were there a couple that did it in the 50s?
This is really funny how this works out, because when the world championship first started, I mean, it really didn't make any sense that Indianapolis would count because the formula was different.
Yeah.
But it was a world championship of drivers, and there was no U.S. Grand Prix, and so they included the Indianapolis 500. Well, during that time, the only Grand Prix driver that came and actually made it was Alberto Ascari. Farina was here, Fangio was here, but they didn't make it. So during that time, Ascari was the only one. And then of the Americans, of the Indianapolis drivers, the only one that started in a Grand Prix was Troy Ruttman. In 1958, he drove in the French Grand Prix. And then in the meantime, in 59, you had the first U.S. Grand Prix at Sebring. And then in 60, it was at Riverside. So there was two rounds. And then they pulled Indianapolis for 61, so Jack Brabham came. And then by the time that, you know, to be followed by Jim Clark and Graham Hill and Jackie Stewart and several of the others that we mentioned, by the time they started coming and finishing up in the front, Indianapolis no longer awarded points towards the World Drivers' Championship.
And that was my question. Was that ever a consideration in the 60s to make Indianapolis a part of the world championship?
I don't think so, because by that time the formula had changed a couple more times over there, and you know, by 61, that the specs were completely different from what they were running here.
Okay, thanks for the call, Chris. 239-1070 is our telephone number. And Bill, you are up next with Donald Davidson on the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Hello, Bill.
Hey, Donald, how you doing tonight?
Just very good, thank you.
Good. Well, I had a Lloyd Ruby question for you.
Okay.
What year did Lloyd Ruby run in the 24 Hours of Le Mans?
1967, as part of the Ford team. He was supposed to go in 66, and he was injured in a plane accident, taking off for right after Indianapolis. The next race was at Milwaukee, and he was taking off. He wasn't the pilot, but he was on board with Dave Laycock, and there were a couple of others. I think Bill Cheeseburg might have been there, now I think about it. And they were taking off from Eagle Creek, and the plane crashed on takeoff, and so Ruby had to miss. He was out for a few weeks, and it meant him not going to Le Mans, and he would have shared a car with Ken Miles. The next year he went and was a DNF. That was the only time that he went. And Ken Miles was deceased by that time. Okay?
Okay. Thank you, Bill. 239-1070 is the telephone number. More room for you for the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson on 1070, The Fan. Donald snickers whenever
legendary.
He hears that. That's right. You're a Hall of Famer now. It's
well.
Gotta be explained. Thanks for joining us from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Donald. I'm Kevin. We had to preempt the end of Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals, so if you were interested in that, it's now a final. Boston has won at Orlando 92-88 to take a one-game-to-none lead. Ray Allen scored 25 points. Paul Pierce with 22 to lead the Celtics. And Vince Carter leads Orlando with 23. That's probably the first basketball update we've had in the Talk of the Gasoline Alley. And while we're throwing in updates at the Dover NASCAR Sprint Cup race, Kyle Busch won that one today. 239-1070 is our telephone number. Questions of historical nature for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500. And Rhea, you are up next with Donald.
Hi, Rhea.
Hi. You mentioned Leon Durey last night, and I don't know anything about Leon Durey other than that Jigger Seroise was named for him.
Well, that's true, yes. Leon Durey Seroise is what his Jigger's name is.
Yes.
You want to know about Leon Durey?
Yes, please. Oh,
all right. Well, actually, that wasn't his real name. His real name was George Stewart, and he was from Philadelphia. And he ran IMCA, and they made this name up for him, and they had him as the Flying Frenchman, and they fabricated that he was a World War One fighter pilot and all this stuff. He was from Philadelphia. And anyway, so at the Speedway, 1922 was his first start. He came out of IMCA and then joined AAA. And he never really had a decent finish at Indianapolis, but he always qualified well, and he was the pole winner in 25 and 28, and his 1-4 lap track records in 1928 stood until 1936, and the reason was that this was the next to last year for the 91.5 cubic inch formula with the superchargers, and although in 29 they came back with the same cars, his record remained unbroken. And then when the formula changed drastically for 1930, when they went to 6-liter engines with no supercharging, then his record stood all the way through the Depression years. But he also was a front-row qualifier in 27. And in 29, he started second behind Cliff Woodbury. And he normally would lead in the early stages, and then something would break down. The best finish that he had was in 1925, which was his first pole year, and he finished sixth with Fred Comer as a relief driver. And he was a relief driver on the sixth place car after he dropped out in 26. He was he co-drove the sixth place car. And then also in 1927, he co-drove for Tommy Milton. Frank Elliott, by the way, was the sixth place finishing driver with Durey as a relief. And then in 27, with the Detroit Front Drive Special, which eventually became rebodied and refigured and was turned into the car that won the race in 1932. Apparently that goes back to 27, apparently. And anyway, there were several drivers on that one, and Durey was one. To finish eighth, he in 1930 he didn't run at all. 31 when I mentioned earlier about the 6-liter engines and no supercharging, you could supercharge if you had a 2-cycle engine, and only a couple of people tried that, but he was one, and he only ran a handful of laps in 31 and dropped out, and that was his last start. and apparently that was one of the loudest cars that was ever here. Well, he became a very successful car owner, and to just boil that one down, in 1933, the Mallory Special was driven by Wilbur Shaw to second place. That was owned by Leon Duray. And then in 34, Maury Rose finished second also for Leon Duray. And just to show how things were different, and rather than, there's a couple of nights where we got a little bit morbid, unintentionally, but just shows you how things were. In 1935, Duray had two cars sponsored by Bosuel Fast, and one of them was assigned to a driver named Johnny Hannon, who was an East Coast dirt track champion. He was the East Coast champion, and all of the races were dirt. So he came here, and he had never been, I don't believe in his entire career, although he was a defending Eastern champion, I don't believe he'd ever been on a track with a hard surface before. So he came to, and certainly nothing as big as the Speedway, and his first hot lap was never completed. He was fatally injured, went over hit the wall at the third turn with such force that it broke a chunk of the wall out, and he was fatally injured. And 9 days later, the car was in the race with a different driver. They just simply took it to a shop somewhere in Speedway, I've never found out where, hammered it out, and then got another driver, Clay Weatherly. And then shortly after the start of the 35 race, he was fatally injured in the same car.
Whoa.
So they hammered it out, and then I'm not sure what happened after that, because he had two cars, and that car did come back several more times, but nobody's been able to figure out which is which. But Leon Duray also owned a nightclub downtown, and I forget what the address was, but it was very close to downtown. It was like 9th and Pennsylvania or something like that. And I think it was a dive, meaning that you go down the stairs.
Oh, okay.
to go. That is the term for a dive. It is
okay.
Actually quite a respectable term, well, used to be, and now it means something else.
Yeah.
And he eventually moved to California and lived in 29 Palms. And he was the team manager. The last time he had any involvement in the race was in 1946 when Jimmy Jackson finished second with the Green Jackson Special. Green because he'd gone to Tech High School and those were the school colors, so he painted his car that way. And Leon Duray was the pit manager. He died in March of 1956, and was really a very colorful character. He went to Europe a couple of times, and I think he thought he was going to blow off the foreigners, and it didn't work out. So he came home very quickly both times. And in fact, the last time he had two front drive Millers. Well, that wasn't the last time, but on a 1929 trip, he took two front-drive Millers, ran out of money very quickly, and then sold the two Millers to Ettore Bugatti in return for the fare home, and the car stayed there for years until Griff Borgeson, who was the editor at Car and Driver at that time, got them out. And one is in private collection, and the other one's at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Hmm. Rhea, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rhea.
Steve is up next with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, Donald. This past winter I bought a book entitled Eddie Called Me Boss.
Yeah.
And when I bought it, I thought it was a book about Eddie Sachs, but it turned out to be just a delightful book by Eddie's car owner,
right.
Dick Summers, who
right.
Turns out I thought was a very interesting character in the book. He explains he went to Harvard. He wrote the book himself. It is a very well-written book.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't really elaborate too much more about himself, and I was just kind of curious about the guy. He did mention that his father had been involved in acquiring the real estate to build the Speedway, and that had somehow kept him involved ever since he was a very young man at the Speedway. And he mentions that he owned a restaurant at 16th
yep.
Street and Meridian that was very prominent, I guess, in the 50s and 60s. But he doesn't
yep.
say too much else, and I just thought he was a very So, again, a very well-written book, very entertaining, and I was just curious a little bit more about the guy.
Well, it's one of the most enjoyable books I've ever read, and I had a chance. I mean, he would bring it to me when he was working on the thing, and he did write it himself. There was he had no editors or anything, because he was one of these people that he was very well-educated and, did crosswords all the time, and his wife, who I still talk to, from time to time, and she talks about the fact that one of the things that irritated him the most was poor grammar and mistakes in the newspapers and everything like that. But he was a true sportsman car owner. The Big Top, by the way, was the restaurant on 16th Street. And a little bit later, he briefly owned a burger joint very close to the track, just when Crawfordsville Road branches off from 16th Street and goes out. And you just go a very short distance, and there's a... In fact, I think where the Quick Lube place is, that okay. is now closed, yeah. Used to be the Satellite Burgeria. And so he was partners on that. But they started out, there was five local businessmen decided to form this corporation to run cars, which they did in 62 and missed the show. And then in 63, by which time they were down to three, and for a while... It was DVS Incorporated, and it was George Deeb, Bob Voigt, and Dick Summers. And they ran Eddie Sachs and Jim Hurtubise and Arnie Knapper, by which time it had now become MVS, because George Deeb, and he owned the Lums. I don't know, that's probably... Do you remember Lums, or is that before your time?
No. Yeah, but,
okay, well, that was a local chain. And anyway, George Deeb got out of it, and then Stan Malass, who was the president of the U.S. Lawn Tennis Association, who lived here, and he was the M of MVS, and then they continued on until 1974. And they never had much luck, but Dick Summers just... I just chuckled through the whole book, because it has tragedy in it, because Sachs was their driver and was lost in the 64 500. The very next race was Milwaukee, and their other driver, Jim Hurtubise, got burned and, you know, basically changed his career. I wouldn't say ended it, because he raced after that, but it changed his career. So, you know, having said those two pieces of tragedy, but through the rest of it, the word you used, delightful, I think is what you said, and certainly that's a term I would use. I just thoroughly enjoyed the work that he did, and he was a tennis umpire when the U.S. clay courts were here, and umpired some pretty major players. And so, and he knew, I remember he would tell me stories about the different tennis players that had been to his house. He just was a very colorful character. When we had local car owners and local sponsors, and again, is my phrase for the month, we're not doing that anymore. Too bad. Well, thank you for asking about it.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Larry, you are up next. 239-1070, by the way, is the number, and we have open phone lines. Larry, it's your turn with Donald.
Oh, good evening, Donald. It's a pleasure to talk to you, sir.
Oh, thank you.
I got a question about one of the more obscure drivers, but he was a pretty decent driver. He was my favorite driver, Mark Donahue. Could you give me a quick scenario about his career? I know he was with Penske.
Yes, for the whole career. Donahue was his Indianapolis career was 1969 through 73, and he was seventh as a rookie in 69, actually ran third for a while, but they had a turbocharger problem, and was still running at the end, but quite some distance down, but because the attrition rate was so high, he did get seventh, and he won Rookie of the Year. In 70, he was second behind Al Unser. 71, he looked like a shoe-in for the race and the pole, and didn't get either. It's a long story, and I don't think we've got time to get into it now, but it ends up that, I mean, he was a shoe-in to win the pole, and went out with a setup other than what he had wanted and got knocked off the pole by Peter Revson. And then in the race had a transmission problem, I think on the 66 lap, which was ironic because that was the car number. Well, then in 1972, which was Penske's fourth start, he did win the race after Gary Bettenhausen had led most of it and then ran into problems late. And so Donahue won it. And then in 73, they switched to... They'd run a Lola in 69 and 70. 71 and 72, they had a McLaren. And then 73, they ran an Eagle. And he was on the outside of the front row and was a DNF in that one. He was a sports car driver. Came up through SCCA Regional, won several titles. but then drove the Can-Am and Trans-Am and also some NASCAR. I mean, he won the Riverside 500 NASCAR race in 1973? Driving a Javelin when American Motors was briefly in NASCAR and working with Penske. After then, Donahue retired or announced his retirement at the end of the 73 season. This was the first year for IROC, IROC.
Mm-hmm.
He announced his retirement, but the final was in February of 74 at Daytona on the road course, and he won the first overall series. And as I think we were talking last night or the night before, I think, perhaps on the Network Indiana program, about the fact that he did retire, but Penske was already in the throes of preparing a Formula One team, and the driver was going to be Peter Revson. He was fatally injured, and then the rumors all summer long while the Formula One car was being readied and almost ready to run, who was going to drive it, and the answer was Donahue. And so he came out of retirement, ran the U.S. and Canadian Grand Prix the reverse order, Canadian and then U.S. Grand Prix at the end of the 74 season, and then did the whole 75 season, or at least up until the point of the Austrian Grand Prix, when on the morning of the race he was out hot lapping. They used to have an early morning hot lap practice session, which they haven't done for years, and he had an accident, was brought back to the pits, said he had a headache, and instead of taking him to the hospital, they didn't have the automatic, check him out and release or keep him or whatever, and he was brought back to the pits and complaining of a headache, and then he collapsed, and then he died 4 days later. But he's very much revered. He was sort of an American Jim Clark in a lot of regards, and still very, very has a huge following today, and he's been gone for, 35 years? Hard to believe.
And when Roger Penske brought his team back to Indianapolis after the split in 2001, were the did Elio win in 68?
Yes, he did.
And was DeFerrin in 66?
I think that's right.
He was still using those car numbers at that time.
Good for bringing that up, because I don't think they'd had that for some time.
Yeah.
And 68, I think, was on a second car. I think David Hobbs ran that as Donahue's teammate in 71. But yes, they did revive those numbers, because certainly all the way through the 70s and the 80s, they didn't use 66, I don't think, after Donahue was deceased.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the call, Larry.
Thank you.
239-1070 is the number. Dan is up next.
Hello, Dan.
Hi, Donald. Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Donald. I was watching highlights of the 1982 race. Noticed there were three brothers, Dale, Don, and Bill Whittington.
Yes.
And I had never heard of them before. Just wondered if you could give me some information about them.
Oh, well, Dale is deceased, and Don and Bill are rather reclusive. They always were. And Don and Bill's career at the Speedway was 80 through 85, but they were not there in 84. Don had the best finish. Bill never made the top 10. They did stand on the gas. Don was 6th in 82, was his best finish. And then history was made in 82 when their younger brother, I think Don and Bill were like 18 months apart, and then Dale was quite a bit younger than them. I think he was like 9 or 10 years younger than Bill, or Don at least. And history was made. You did have three brothers in the same 500 at the same time, because the Chevrolets never did that, and the Unsers never did that. They came down for the start, and there was an accident, we'll just say that Dale Whittington got tangled up in that, and so he got 33rd. And maybe, somebody asked me this the other day, they said, is he the only person that got a finishing position that never even made it to the start finish line, because where his accident took place, he actually came to a rest before they got to the start finish line. Anyway, he has been deceased for about 5 years, And Don and Bill had they were quite wealthy, but some of their money there was controversy surrounding how the income was derived, and that they were both guests of the government, one for 7 years and the other one for 18 months, and they both long since been out. And Don is like a cat with nine lives because he hasn't driven a race car for many years in competition. The first time anybody heard of the Whittingtons was when they were teamed with Klaus Ludwig to win the 1975 24 Hours of Le Mans. And anyway, Don was into air racing. And I think he had a Mustang, North American Mustang, and he had at least three crashes. I mean, he crashed into the sea at one time. And just a survivor. They were very interesting people, but they didn't say much. And everybody sort of kind of wondered what was going on with them. And it really wasn't very much of a secret. And to say eventually things got caught up with them, and they were the guests of the government for a while.
Dan, thank you for the call.
All right, thank you very much.
239-1070 is the number. Kelly is up next with Donald Davidson.
Donald.
Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Donald, just tell me what you can about Lotus and the number 5 car and how that harkens back. And I apologize if this has already come up before,
no.
But I haven't been on the line here for a while.
No,
so
it's
Lotus number 5 car.
It's okay. No, it hasn't come up before. I can't give you a very clear answer because it's not Team Lotus, but
it's a sponsorship.
It's a sponsorship by. There's a sports car that's being offered, and somebody told me the other day what it's called. It's the Lotus something or rather.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's some rather expensive high-end sports car, and that one of the ways of advertising the thing is through this sponsorship. And how it came about, I have no idea. And somebody had the idea, well, let's paint it up like a Lotus with the green and the yellow stripe. And then some of the media, I think Bob Jenkins being one of them, made the suggestion, why don't you do the numbers the way they used to?
Yeah.
With the white ball with the big black numbers like they used to be when Clark and Bobby Johns and Al Unser were running the cars here. So and then Takuma Sato is the driver, and they haven't really had a lot of luck so far. But somebody came up to me the other day and said, hey, that's a great idea. This was just a fan came up to me in the museum. Said, that's a great idea. Why don't they get other cars painted up like retro Formula One paint jobs? And I thought, well, all it needs is money. It's a deal. They didn't do it just as a tribute to Lotus. They did it because it's it's part of the sponsorship.
Okay, Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you. 239-1070 is the number. Ron is up next on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan.
Hello.
Yes, Donald. Yes. I wanted to make a comment about Tom Benford.
Okay.
You did an excellent job on him, as you do everything. But Tom Benford was also very instrumental in getting the U.S. Nationals.
That's absolutely right, yes.
In Neffis Raceway Park, which is now ORP,
yeah.
He met with Wally Parks in Detroit.
Yes.
And convinced him to bring it here and make a permanent home for it.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, thank you for bringing that up. And I had not thought of that, but let me throw in a couple of things here. He actually was the president of Raceway Park, and what that was going to be was a multi-purpose facility which kept growing legs. Originally, there wasn't going to be a drag strip. I think it was going to be an oval with a road course, and then there was all kinds of other ideas that there'd be a golf course and swimming pools and all this, a lot of other things that didn't get happen. And then the drag strip, I think, was far along in the planning, but maybe that wasn't the best phrase to use because things were happening so quickly, but it wasn't in the original idea. And Tom Benford stamped himself as quite a salesman because Detroit was where the Nationals didn't have a permanent home. 1955 was the first year. Great Bend, Kansas was the first one, and they had it in Oklahoma City, and they kept moving around. Well, they went to Detroit, and so Tom Binford went up there, met with Wally Parks, and apparently they walked down to the end of the drag strip, and Tom made the proposal, you know, we're building this facility. How about moving the U.S. Nationals for next year to Raceway Park? And they made a deal, and they hadn't even built the drag strip yet. Mm. So it was all done on a handshake and a dream. But, yes, you're absolutely right. And then it indeed kicked off here in 61. And when I mentioned DA Lubricants, they sold shares. And they had a lot of that. Tony Holman had a chunk, and Charlie Brockman. Roger Ward was part of that. A fellow named Frank Dickey, who was at one time the mayor of New Bremen and was the promoter of the New Bremen racetrack. But they also had a lot of fans bought shares. A lot of them bought one share. Anyway, the address for where you would apply to buy a share was the address they gave was actually the DA Lubricant headquarters on West 29th Street, where Tom Binford was also president. But yes, absolutely. If it wasn't for Tom Binford, we might not have Raceway Park today.
Wow. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing that up.
We'll sneak in Ian before we're done. Ian, real quick for us.
Hello, Ian.
Hello, Donald. Please talk to you, sir.
Thank you.
I believe that there was an association at one point between some NASA astronauts, including perhaps Gus Grissom, and the car sponsorship.
Yes, there was. That was... the GCR Corporation with Jim Rathman, and it was Gordon Cooper and Gus Grissom. So GCR was Grissom, Cooper, and Rathman, and they didn't have much luck. They did, that was 66 and 67, and then it went away. And I think the best finish that I can think of was Art Pollard was fourth at Milwaukee, but they never did get a car in the race at the Speedway. They had the Pure Oil Special in 76 with Leroy Yarborough, and it was crashed on the last qualifying day by poor Greg Weld, and then they were here with two cars in 67, and neither one of them made it. But they did run a few races, but the thing was dissolved at the end of 67. But, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Yeah, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ian. We will be back with another fresh edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley tomorrow night at 6. If you just tuned in, there will be a podcast available, the podcast of the weekends, or if you have friends you hear of that didn't catch us over the weekend, send them to Indy500Coverage.com or 1070TheFan.com, and they can find the podcast for tonight, last night, or any of the shows throughout the week, including the second hour, which is on Network Indiana stations around the state throughout the week. So we'll be back tomorrow night at 6 here on 1070 The Fan. Hour number 2 will be on Network Indiana stations and then on the podcast, and then at 7 here on 1070 The Fan tomorrow night, Kurt Cavan joins me for Trackside as we recap day 3 of practice, weather permitting, here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Again, recapping today, Elio Castroneves for the second straight day, the quickest 227.046 miles an hour, the quickest of 33 cars. The only incident, Dan Weldon made contact coming out of turn number 4. He has been checked and released. He does have a bruise on his right foot. We'll have updates at the track tomorrow morning, starting just after 11 here on 1070 The Fan. Thank you, Don. We'll see
you
tomorrow.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you. And thank you for yesterday. That was a lot of fun on the stage.
We had fun on the Q&A on the stage. Hope to do that again. Thanks so much for joining us this evening on 1070 The Fan.